Your hands were made for greatness. Mighty hands for painting, paneling, and clicking the submit order button on homedepot.com to get that duvet. And these Egyptian cotton towels delivered right to your door. Do more with decor at the Home Depot. Save up to 30% on select bedding and bath. Now at homedepot.com. More saving, more kinds of doing. Valid on select items online only. Free delivery on select items $45 or more. Enter promo code BEDBATH15 at purchase for an extra 15% off. Visit homedepot.com for more information.
Welcome, everyone. You're listening to Creating a Family, talk about adoption and foster care. Today, we're going to be talking about a subject I am absolutely fascinated by, nature versus nurture in adoption. I know you're going to enjoy this show. Here's a simple starting over. Welcome, everyone, to Creating a Family, talk about adoption and foster care. This is a subject that I am absolutely fascinated by, and I think you will be too. Everyone, if you are listening, and of course you are, or you wouldn't be here right now, I have a favor to ask. We really depend upon your comments, and we don't ask a lot of you, but this is something we really do need for you to do, and that is pop over to iTunes and give us a rating. You can do a star rating, or if you're feeling generous, you can write a few lines. We really do appreciate them, and we read every single one of them. So thank you so much. This show is brought to you by the Jockey Being Family Foundation. One of their missions is to support adoptive families post-adoption to keep them together forever. And one way they do that is through their Bear, their backpack program, their Backpack Bear program. It's actually a backpack program, and in the backpack they have these adorable bears. They're free to agencies to provide to their newly adopted kids. And as I said, it comes with an adorable bear and a blanket. It also is it's created with the initials of the child. And perhaps most important, it has free parenting resources in the backpack for the parents as well. It is a wonderful mission from Jockey Being Family Foundation. You can suggest it to your agency by going to, or you can suggest it to them, and they can get information by going to the website jockeybeingfamily.com. This show, as well as all the resources at Creating a Family, would not be possible without the generous support of the agencies that believe in our mission of providing unbiased, accurate information to families both pre- and post-adoption. These are agencies whose heart is in education, and that's why they support us. One such partner is Adoptions from the Heart. They have helped build over 6,000 families. They've been in existence since 1985, and they do domestic infant adoption, and they work with people all across the United States. The topic today is nature versus nurture in adoption. I don't know if it's because I'm an adoptive parent or if it's just because I'm absolutely fascinated by genetics, but regardless, it is a topic that I am very interested in. And we will interview Sally Ann Ray. She has been we're interviewing two people. The first is Sally Ann Ray. She has been the study coordinator for well over almost 30 years for one of the most renowned adoption research projects in the world, the Colorado Adoption Project. And they focus on investigating genetics and environmental influences on human behavior. We also have Dr. Alexandra Burt. She is an associate professor of behavioral genetics with affiliations with the Michigan State University Twin Registry. And her research focuses on the role of genes and the environment and how they interplay in the development of children. A topic that is infinitely interesting, and these are two of the top researchers in the United States in this field. This is a re-airing of a show we did a number of years ago. The information is truly evergreen and one of my favorites, and one of yours too, which is why we're bringing it to you again. Enjoy. Welcome, Sally Ann and Alex, to Creating a Family.
Thank you.
I wanted to begin by saying, I find the interplay between genetics in the environment, as I mentioned, infinitely fascinating. Maybe it's because I'm a parent through both birth and adoption, or maybe just because I'm a research geek. But in any event, I could talk about this forever. But I can only imagine, as I think about it, that it would be very difficult to tease out in real life, when you're using real life subjects, the relative influences of gene and the environment. Or genetics in the environment, I should say. Alex, how do you design studies to figure out what is influencing what?
Well, you're right. It is actually difficult, and you have to be creative and think outside the box a little bit to accomplish that. But there are a couple of different ways that people have come up with, and these are designs that that we know work and that have been successful. So the one type of design, probably the primary design, is the twin study design, a classical twin study design. So basically what you have are twins who are growing up in the same family. They were in the uterus at the same time, so they were exposed to the same or very similar uterine environment. But different types of twins have different degrees of genetic relatedness. So identical or monozygotic twins are the result of a single conception that, for reasons unknown to us, split into two. So they are genetically identical beings. They are actually nature's clones. Whereas fraternal or dizygotic twins, as we call them, are the result of two different conceptions, so two eggs and two sperm. And so they share only as many genes as regular full siblings, so about 50%. So what you have is this kind of interesting natural experiment where you've got, you know, genetically identical beings and then just sort of regular siblings who happen to be in the womb at the same time and are the same age. And if you can compare similarity across those two types of twins, it allows you to make inferences regarding the genetic or environmental origins of the condition. So if identical twins are more similar than fraternal twins, we ascribe that to genetic influences, and if identical and fraternal twins are equally similar, then we think it's environmental influences.
Interestingly enough, what a lot of people don't realize, I mean, I think everyone knows that dizygotic twins, fraternal twins, are more common through in vitro fertilization. In fact, they're quite common. In fact, the majority of twins now are born dizygotic twins are as a result of IVF. However, what a lot of people don't realize is monozygotic twins are also more common through IVF. I realize you probably know that, but
they did. That's right. They are more common, and we don't know 100% for sure why. Some speculations have been that the issues that were making it hard to get pregnant in the first place, maybe just a suboptimal uterine environment is actually the term I've heard. Mm-hmm. May make it harder for embryos to implant, and somehow that process, maybe they're floating around for a little bit longer, and in that process, that extra time they split.
Oh, interesting. I had not ever heard the reason.
That's the only explanation I've ever heard that has made any sense to me.
Yeah, that's
speculative, though. I mean, there's no certainty about that.
Exactly. It is speculative.
Yeah. At this point, we know is that, and I think that the majority of people don't really realize that both types of twins are more common, but then I think a lot of people don't really realize that they're two distinct types of twins. Well, and clearly, Sally Ann, another study would be an adoption study. That's what Alex just mentioned was the classical twin study. But how do adoption studies work in that? How do you design those to kind of tease out the distinction between nature versus nurture, genes and environment?
Well, in our adoption study, which is, almost unique, we collected information from birth parents who were intending to place their children for adoption, generally before the children were placed. So we collected a set of data for them. Then of those who placed their children, we contacted the adoptive parents to see if they would be willing to be in the study as well, and about 75% of those who were contacted did. And so for those families, we have assessments on the genetic parents, the birth parents, and we have assessments on the adoptive parents, the rearing parents. So we have genetic and environmental parents. We have two different parents. In our study, we also have a control group that was matched to the adoptive, the rearing parents. And so in a way analogous to what Alex was saying, we can look at similarities, either parent-offspring or sibling, between genetically related people, those in the control family, who share 50% of their genes in common, like the fraternal twins do, and in the adoptive families where they share no genetic commonality, obviously, with their adoptive parents. So we had pairs of genetically unrelated siblings, and then we also have parent-offspring analyses. So the degree to which the adoptive children, let's say in a sibling analysis, are the same level of commonality as the control children, that must be an environmental influence. And the degree to which the control children are more similar, that must be a genetic influence. That's oversimplified, but that's how it works. And one of the
and your children, the people you were following, were placed at birth. Is that correct?
They were placed on average within a month.
Okay.
They never spent time with their birth parents, though. They left the hospital and went to foster care. And some of them it was a couple of days, and a few of them it was as long as 6 months in foster care, but the average is about a month. So there's really no environmental influence from the birth parents other than prenatal influences.
Right, okay.
What's really useful about having both an adoption study and a twin study is that there could be a special twin environment, a special twin shared environment, since twin siblings are exactly the same age and had that same uterine environment. So what looks like an environmental effect could just be the status of being twins. So if you have a study where you can compare all those groups, you can really get some good answers.
Right, which is, and for our listeners, we do have a show coming up in January where we're going to look at the three top longitudinal adoption studies, which include twin studies and other studies as well, to just see in general what we're learning. This show is more specific to environmental and genetic influences. But before we leave the discussion, a lot of people, in fact, we've had guests on the show talking about twin studies where twins separated at birth. Alex, I realize that that's not the type of twin study you are talking about, but what does that study add to the whole environment and genetics debate?
They're a fascinating design from a research perspective, although from other perspectives, not so much perhaps. But from a research perspective, particularly if you've got monozygotic or identical twins who are separated at or near birth and are reared in separate homes, you really have it's almost like an alternate universe. From a researcher, you've got, two genetically identical beings growing up, at the same time, so they're often exposed to the same sort of broad cultural influences, but they're not being exposed to the same family, the same schools, et cetera. And there have been some sort of very, very peculiar similarities that have, sort of made the popular press because they're so, fascinating, like identical twins reared apart who name their kids the same thing and
like the same toothpaste
and like the same food, peculiar. There was one case I heard, these were actually identical triplets, monozygotic triplets reared apart, and they were all wrestlers in high school, and they all had the same sort of unique pin move.
Wow.
That they would use. Probably as, a result of their, just the way their bodies are built. And
right. I mean, actually, I shouldn't say, wow, that does make sense. They have, because pin moves are based on what your, the physics of your body. And
that's right.
So I suppose that isn't. Yeah. And of course, we all hope that there are no more subjects, being developed for these studies.
Exactly.
Obviously, nobody
exactly.
in their right mind is doing it intentionally. But these are for people who are listening. Don't worry. Nobody's doing this intentionally. These are for whatever reason. And I suspect that that there will be a few subjects that will have been raised in totally different cultures, because we certainly know that there have been twins separated in international adoption where one twin that is adopted and one not. There clearly would not be too many of those. All right. Now, Sally Ann, when I first approached you about being on a show, and I had titled it "Nature versus Nurture" because that is the kind of the shorthand in our society for discussing this, you were real clear in your response that it's seldom nature versus nurture, but more often nature and nurture. So, in your studies, have you found that there are some things mostly governed by genes, or to put it another way, are there some things that you think are more influenced or more inherited traits versus other things?
Well, certainly. I mean, obviously, height is almost exclusively genetic. Environment influences height nonetheless, though, because, you know, a population on average, as it gets better nutrition, can, you know, the height increases. But the variation within that population among individuals is predominantly a genetic influence.
Mm-hmm.
Appearance
in general.
Yes.
Hair color, eye color, things like
right.
that.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, I mean, I would say that there is a genetic influence on virtually every human trait, and there's an environmental influence on virtually every human trait as well. I don't think most modern social scientists any longer look at a debate between nature and nurture. We see them as both being important, and we see them as interacting. I think people are sometimes surprised that the field of behavioral genetics has actually elucidated a lot about the environment. I mean, that's some of its most important findings, that shared environment within a family is not as important as people would think. The family environmental influences tend to affect children differently. That's one not, you know, counterintuitive to many people finding. We also have done research that indicates that a lot of what we think of as pure environment is genetically influenced, like people choose their environments. And then there is also gene-environment interaction that takes place, where if you have a genetic risk and an environmental stressor, you'll experience a condition. So all three of those things are taking place.
I want to come back later to talk about the shared environment influencing children differently, because I find that interesting. But before we do that, I do want to touch on, I asked people to suggest things that they would like to know how genetics and environment interplay. And certainly the first one is intelligence. I know, Sally Ann, I'm going to ask this one to you as well, because I know that you guys in the Colorado Adoption Project have done some research talking about cognitive development and its heritability. So is our IQ controlled by our genes and or our environment?
You want me to go first?
Yes, Sally Ann, you go first, since I know you guys have done something on that.
Yes, there's a huge genetic influence on IQ. In our longitudinal studies, in infancy and early childhood, there also is a family influence as well. But as children grow older, they come to resemble their biological parents rather than the parents who are rearing them. So many people would think that the more time you spend with your rearing family, the more that environment would influence you. But in fact, the older you get, the more you become your true self. And it's not entirely genetic, but it's a strongly genetic trait. And that doesn't mean that genes are, you know, completely predictive. Obviously, you could have really deprived environments that would depress a person's potential. You know, you could be eating lead paint or locked in a closet or something, and you wouldn't achieve your potential. So environment in that way could have a huge effect. But across normal middle-class environments, genes are a very important part of one's IQ.
I would assume, just from having research, that this comes up more often in cases of international adoption from countries of extreme poverty and malnutrition, that the intrauterine environment, certainly malnutrition during pregnancy, can influence. But I hear what you're saying.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I like to think of it as there being a lot of environmental ways to depress anyone's ability for anything. fetal alcohol syndrome, bad nutrition for the mother.
Sure,
All sorts of things like that. And for a child, stresses. In our study, the children were placed at birth. A lot of your families who adopt, the children are adopted much later, and all sorts of experiences that they might have had would make a huge difference.
No, we have people, we've just as many domestic adoptions at birth as well, so it's not, but I'm always, we have both in our audience.
Right, right.
All right, Alex, let's talk about...
If you'll allow me, there's one little... I appreciated everything Sally said, but just to piggyback, there's actually a meta-analysis that came out a few years ago that found that the IQs of adopted children are actually considerably higher than those of their biological siblings who were not adopted but were reared by their birth parents, over a standard deviation higher, which is quite a bit. So there is evidence, although that study doesn't clarify what aspects of the adoptive environment might be providing that additional support. There certainly is evidence out there that adoption is a wonderful thing, sort of,
yes,
for the child.
Right.
Even at the level of IQ, which we think of as Sally said, as quite heritable.
Well, you know what? I've often wondered this. And I know that I'm going to be oversimplifying it a little, but I've wondered if, say, the range of IQ is heavily genetically influenced, but where you fall in that range might have a lot to do with your environment, not just your nutritional environment, but also what you're exposed to, how stimulating, how much you've been read to, what schools you go to and things like that. Would that explanation, and I realize that the meta-analysis you're discussing did not give the explanation, but would that explanation explain what that meta-analysis found?
I mean, it certainly makes very good intuitive sense. There is a paper by Eric Turkheimer several years ago. He found that even though IQ is quite heritable, the heritability of IQ varies with the socioeconomic status of the child. So it's actually more heritable in more advantaged environments, kind of consistent with the idea that that in advantaged environments you're being exposed to, everything is allowing you to maximize your potential.
Right. You could also argue
so
that the testing itself for IQ is geared towards people from an advantaged environment. But that's a whole other issue and a whole other show. So
right. That is right. That's absolutely right.
We won't go there. But that's a fascinating, and it actually makes such intuitive sense to me, as you said, I realize that intuition is not necessarily what we should be talking about in a show that's based on science, but nonetheless. Let's talk now about temperament. And first of all, Sally Ann, can you give us kind of an idea of what we mean by what's included under the general heading of temperament?
Temperament and personality. Temperament is what we call personality in childhood, basically, and personality is what we call it in adulthood. refers to things like a child's predilection to be happy or fussy or goal-oriented, things like that.
Yeah, calm, outgoing, introversion,
right,
that type of stuff. Okay.
Right, right.
Okay, so Sally Ann, if you'll start, and then Alex, if you'll say what you're finding in your studies. But what are you finding as far as basic temperament or personality? Is that influenced by our genes more, or by our environment, or more likely by the interplay between the two?
Again, personality, like cognition, there's a very large genetic influence on that. I would say that this one is one that has a huge interplay of genes and environment. A child who has a natural tendency to have problems, their genetic liability from their birth parent, who is reared in a negative environment, those problems will more likely manifest than if they're... And by negative, I mean lack of warmth and attachment and things like that. So there's a lot of research that indicates high heritability for personality, but there's also a lot of research that indicates it's an interplay between the environment and genes.
Alex, what are you finding in your studies, or the studies that you know of, not just necessarily the ones you're involved in, but others that you're studying?
I think there is actually, Sally Ann's absolutely right, there is a fair amount of evidence that maladaptive experiences in life can sort of further augment a tendency to be, highly emotional, prone to anger outbursts, just negative, sort of a negative Nelly sort of thing. They can definitely push you in that direction. There's also evidence, though, that in addition to things just happening to you, which are unfortunate and that can have these unfortunate consequences, people either evoke or seek out experiences that are consistent with their temperament. So this is something that we all know that we do, but we don't necessarily talk about it that way. So a shy child is just unlikely to want to go play with a group of 10 children on the playground. They might want to go play with one or two, but not with 10, right? Mm-hmm. So they're having just an entirely different set of experiences, of social experiences in their life. They also evoke different reactions from others. My favorite example of this is, let's say you walk into a room and there's two toddlers. I have a three-year-old, so this is a very salient example for me. You walk into a room, there's two toddlers. One is fussing and rolling around the floor and having, quite a tantrum. And the other one comes running up to you with a big hug and all happy to see you. I mean, if you think about your reaction to those child, which child are you going to feel in that moment more positively inclined to? Mm-hmm. Obviously the second, right? So
right.
To the extent that the child's behavior in that moment was genetically influenced, you have just responded to their genetically influenced characteristics. So
mm-hmm.
Sally's absolutely right. It isn't nature v. nurture. They are so intertwined. You create your own environment. Things happen to you. It's very complicated.
And
what Alex is saying
even applies to your own family. Like a lot of social science research in the past would look at a negative home environment, parents that were, that behaved negatively towards their children, and they would think that that had caused the child's negativity. But just like this toddler in the playroom that isn't even your own, in your own home, if you have a child that's always fussy, that's likely to create negativity in the parent. So even within the family, the child may be evoking a family environment.
Yeah.
That is so true, and let me put in I'm doing a show in, let me get the exact date, December 7th, so 2 weeks from now, there's a new book out called The Sibling Effect, and it was profiled on the cover of Time magazine last month, I think, and he talks about it, and I will say that I have yet to read the book. I've read the article. I want to read the book closer to the time so it's relevant, but he talks about favoritism within families, and I can't help but think that sometimes it's less favoritism than one child is just easier than another, at least at that particular age. And that brings me to the next thing that I wanted to talk about here, and that is, there's this whole goodness of fit theory, and as you talk about temperament, it occurs to me that there are, if our basic temperament is influenced heavily by genetics through adoption, is it more likely that you could have a child placed with you that isn't as good a fit for your personality, or do similar personalities perhaps work against each other so it might actually be a better fit for your personality? Alex, I'll ask that one to you.
Yeah. I had several different thoughts simultaneously went through my mind. So one is that, sort of piggybacking on the last bit there, is that the parent-child relationship, like any other relationship, is a relationship. Both people are involved in that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
The child is contributing to that relationship, and so is the parent. And as parents, we tend to think of these things as more one-way streets, but they really aren't. And so that leads to your question of goodness of fit. I mean, I think it certainly is possible. And I have no doubt that it's happened that a shy child has been placed with very extroverted parents and has not enjoyed all of the social things that they have had to do because that's what their parents like to do. I have no doubt that that's happened. Fortunately, I think for adoptive parents, even in biological families, parent-child similarity for personality is relatively low. Even though it is genetic, it seems to be the sort of gene. It seems to be more about genes that interact with each other, rather than you get one copy and that makes you taller or shorter sort of thing. This is more about the interaction between genes, and so siblings are more similar in their personalities than parents and children are, biological siblings compared to biological parents and children. The parent-child correlation is pretty small. It's like 0.1, which is quite small. So in that sense, adoptive families aren't that much different. It's the average correlation is lower, but it's not 0.1 is not that high. So,
and we all know families through biology where there is simply the parent and the child really aren't a natural compatible fit. But that gets, for me, the whole idea of the goodness of fit seems to be empowering from a parent standpoint, because to a large extent, if we're aware of it, we can adapt. We're the parents. I mean, we're the adults in this situation, although I agree with you, it's a two-way street. We are the adults, and children are not known necessarily for their, although some are, I suppose that's a temperamental factor, some are more adaptable. But as a parent, with the, there are things that I am alike with my children and things that I am different, but those things that I am different, if I am aware of it, I don't have to attach a value judgment. You are, because you are shy and you hang back, you are bad. If you just changed your behavior, you could just, you know, buck it up and get there, you would enjoy it. That's a choice that a parent has to make. The other way to approach it is, oh, you are an introverted personality and that's equally valuable. We all bring something. So I guess to me it's empowering if indeed parents treat it that way. We've talked about temperament and personality, but I also am fascinated by the concept of how genes affect behavior. And again, I'd like to have both of you talk towards this, because I often think of behavior as, you know, as more of, obviously your temperament influences in some way your behavior, but an outgoing, rambunctious child can still be a child that behaves. So it's interesting to me to think of genes affecting something such as behavior. Sally Ann, how do genes affect behavior, or do they?
Well, definitely they do. I'm not even completely sure I understand the question. I mean, I think of behavior as everything you do. Your cognitive performance is a behavior.
Valid point. Let's say conduct. Well, and where I want to eventually get to this is the whole idea of antisocial behavior, and that's an area that I know that Alex has studied in general. I didn't want to begin with the negative, the antisocial. So I was, would conduct make it? Would that be easier to discuss?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay.
In our research group, we also have an emphasis on antisocial behavior and substance abuse. Our adoption sample and our twin sample both have been enrolled in a really large study of those problem behaviors. And there is definitely a genetic influence on those behaviors. As I was kind of implying earlier, this is one of the areas where the genetic liability and the environmental risk have a huge amount of interplay in that we had a study with our adoption sample from the kids when they were, I think, about 12 years old, and children who had a genetic liability as measured by negative emotionality in the birth parent and whose adoptive parents divorced had a much poorer outcome than either children who only had the genetic liability or only had the divorce. So this is a huge area of interplay between genes and environment.
Let me, this is a question we have received from Suzanne. Let me read that so that gives us something to, because she's giving specific examples here. Suzanne says, we adopted twins whose birth father is a drug and alcohol addict. As far as we know, their first mom did not drink or take drugs at all during her pregnancy. She also does not have an addiction problem either before or after their birth. We are wondering if an addictive personality or whatever causes a person to become addicted to drugs or alcohol is inherited. Is our son more likely to get it than our daughter? So let's use her question in general to kind of talk about substance abuse and addiction. Alex, Sally Ann has just talked about the fact that, in fact, there is certainly a heritable component to this and an environmental component. How does it interplay?
Well, I mean, along the lines we've been describing, actually. So people both are responsive. You know, we are very plastic beings in the sense that we're very adaptable to lots of different types of environments. If you just think of all the different types of environments that humans live in, you know, the very, very cold places, very, very hot places, we eat very different foods, and we're very adaptable as a species, and so we're just very responsive to our environments, and that responsiveness, it goes all the way down to our genome. We are just very responsive to our environments, and so the idea of this gene-environment interaction is very potent, particularly for some things, and behavior is one of them. But again, there's also this idea of people seeking out environments that are consistent with their behavioral tendencies. So kids who enjoy breaking the rules are less likely to go hang out with kids who don't like those same sorts of things. And so what you find is that kids who like to do sort of naughty things select each other, and then their behavior increases, right? So you've got both the gene-environment interaction and the selection effects operating. And so in terms
let me ask you a question on that. So kids who enjoy breaking rules, is that a genetic influence, or is that
there is some genetic influence on it, but there is also quite a bit of environmental influence.
But with the same genetics that would lead one child to be a rule breaker in the naughty sense, and in the sense of doing things that are destructive to herself or himself, would those same genes in a different environment lead that person to be a an entrepreneur or a skydiver? Or is it the breaking the rule part that is heritable, or is it the stimulation seeking part?
So that both are heritable, but there are theories out there that are really interesting, that some particularly successful people who really took big chances in their life, you know, had they been raised in different circumstances, if they would have ended up in jail.
Because
they were taking bad
question.
Chances instead of good chances. I think I don't know of a lot of empirical evidence to support it, but for me, I'm also a clinical psychologist. To me, that theory resonates with me personally. But
in one of our studies right now, we're looking at risk taking behavior, and it is exactly as Alex suggests. It is associated both with positive and negative risks, and it depends on the guidance and the choices. I feel like Suzanne is actually asking a question as a parent. You know, she's looking for guidance and advice here. And mm-hmm. what I would say is that, yes, if she has two adoptive children and one of them comes from a family with a history of substance abuse problems, the child from that family is at more risk for developing substance problems.
And that's something to say for those of us who have biological children as well.
Absolutely.
In our family history we have
right.
Substance abuse, it's and quite frankly, if you look very far in most of our family trees, climbing
you're
up those little ladders,
it.
You'll find
yeah.
it. And now she asked the question, she has twins.
Yes.
It sounds like one is a boy and one is a girl. Is there, she says, is our son more likely and to get it, I think what she means, to inherit, I suspect is what she's asking, the risk-taking, or in this case she was specifically talking about substance abuse and addiction. Is there, Sally Ann, is there a gender component associated with the heritability?
Not really. I don't think there's a gender component associated with the heritability, but there is a gender component associated with the manifestation. For example, there's a lot of association between substance abuse and other types of what we would consider bad behavior. And so it may not be that the child is inheriting a specific tendency to do substances so much as a tendency to engage in very risky behavior that can have negative consequences. And for a boy, it might be doing substances and driving fast cars, and for a girl, it might be having inappropriate sex at an early age. So it's
and
not
just,
really...
I mean, boys are all boys. Every male is technically speaking, at higher risk for substance use disorders.
Right. So
really?
Risk, but
yeah,
it's
yeah.
not heritability
oh, yes.
that's higher. It's just that the risk of the behavior is higher.
Is higher in men, and not because
yeah.
it's more heritable in them, but
okay.
because it is just a disorder that is expressed more frequently in males than in females, period.
Well, my sons and I are going to have a discussion tonight, poor guys.
Yeah,
not the
but
first
I will
one.
Say, I will say for, I wanted to say for Suzanne that, you know, yes, this is substance use. There is a heritable component to it, and if I were Suzanne, I'd probably keep an extra close eye. But on the same, but at the same time, it's important to remember that substance use disorders in particular, you know, we've been talking in general about this idea of the gene-environment interaction, that environmental experiences can impinge on the individual and alter, you know, genetic expression or augment it, as the case may be. But with substance use disorders, it really couldn't be a clearer example of a gene-environment interaction. You can have every single gene in the world for a substance use disorder, and there is one easy way not to get it. Just never
try it. Yeah, I mean, that was where I was going to go to for Suzanne, too. Even though her child has a higher risk than someone who doesn't have that family background, or the kinds of things that they talk about in the television ads, like early discussion and, you know, explaining to the child that, in fact, they have that risk. You know, an adopted away child who doesn't know they have the risk may not have the tools, but a child who knows they have that risk can acquire more tools at an early age, and that can certainly make a difference.
Yep. Another issue that often comes up in adoption, in fact, we hear this one a lot, and we hear it from people who are trying to make a decision on whether this birth mother match or adoption referral is a good match for them. And it's when they have one of the risk factors that there is sometimes information on is mental illness of some sort in the birth family. And it could be in the birth mom, the birth father, or the birth grandmother, birth grandfather. Usually we don't get too much further back than that. And so the question that comes up is, what is the risk for this child? And oftentimes it's not from parents trying to decide whether or not to accept the referral or the match, but for knowing what they need to be aware of and proactive steps. So I think it would be helpful if we not talk about mental illness as just a very broad group, but let's be specific. Let me start with, let me just throw out bipolar. And let's say I'll start with you, Alex, and then we'll move to schizophrenia. Sally Ann, you could take that one. But Alex, how heritable is bipolar?
Bipolar and schizophrenia are both very heritable.
Okay.
They're some of the most heritable disorders, like 70-80% are numbers that have been batted around. I mean, they're quite heritable.
Okay, when you say 70-80%, what do you mean? If the birth
that requires a little bit of explanation. So we're saying that all of the differences between people on this trait, 70-80% of them can be accounted for by genetic influences. And if you look at the way these disorders are transmitted in families, it's there's a lot of familial transmission.
But specifically from an adoptive parent standpoint, they may have information that the birth mother or the birth father has been diagnosed with bipolar or schizophrenia. And what they are trying to figure out is, all right, what are the odds that this child is going to also have either bipolar or schizophrenia? Is there data out there on that?
They are at increased risk of developing bipolar or schizophrenia, depending on the parent's diagnosis. But that said, these are relatively low base rate disorders. These are not common disorders. They're severe. Unfortunately, they're not that common. So schizophrenia, you see in about 1% of the population on average, and this is actually around the world. About 1% of the population around the world will be diagnosed with schizophrenia in their lifetime. If you're the child, a biological child of a schizophrenic parent, you are at more risk, but that risk is actually about 10%.
All right,
there's a 90% chance this child will not develop schizophrenia and a 10% chance they will.
Sally Ann, you were going to say something. What were you going to
that
say?
That was exactly what I was going to say.
Exactly.
That even though the disease is very heritable, like, for example, in an adoption study, an adopted away child of a schizophrenic parent, about 10% of the time will also be schizophrenic, but it doesn't matter whether it doesn't matter whether they're raised with an adoptive parent who's schizophrenic or not. I mean, the incidence is the same. It's almost exclusively genetic, but
yep.
It's still a low occurring thing. So for almost any disorder out there, we as biological parents can create that, can pass that on to our children as well. You know,
even if we don't have it,
it could still be in our family tree somewhere. So there's a lower incidence, but you know, there's no guarantees when you have a child, no matter how you have them.
No, it's funny. I have one of our community has said this before, and I thought it was a. She said it with a joke. She is a mom through egg donation, and she said the conversation we were having was that hard for you to move past genetic parenting? And she said, not at all. She said, I looked at my family tree, and she goes, I was thrilled that I had the opportunity to be pregnant with a child that didn't carry my genes. She said, because you know, she goes, they really stink. She goes, you know. If you look very far back, and I think the truth is if any of us look pretty far back, I always say I don't want to climb too high on my family tree because no telling what we will find. What
mental
about
illness in general is quite common. I mean, if you collapse across all disorders, it's about 25% of people will have a diagnosable mental illness in their lifetime. That's a lot. I mean, the chance that any one person comes from a family where no one has anything is low,
yeah,
very, very low.
And they probably just don't know about it.
Right. Even if they don't have it, they don't have a formal diagnosis, everyone kind of has a sense, well, you know how Uncle Bob is.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, yeah.
Yeah. So what about some of the other, let's touch on some of the other more common mental disorders, and I almost don't want to call them that because some are so. But what are some of the other things, and how heritable are they? Alex, let me ask you that one. Obsessive compulsive is one. Depression would be another one. Things such as that.
So obsessive compulsive disorder is a relatively I think shows like Monk, which is a fun show, but I think they've made it seem like it's not that big a deal for a disorder, but it actually is a pretty serious mental disorder.
Mm-hmm.
That one's pretty heritable. Some of the more common mental illnesses are less heritable. So depression is actually a disorder that is relatively less heritable. It still has a genetic component, don't get me wrong. It's just less heritable than other sorts of disorders. Anxiety disorders are a little bit more heritable than depression. Anxiety disorders are actually the most common type of disorder in the world, and are for the most part quite treatable.
Mm-hmm.
There are cases where it doesn't work out, but anxiety disorders are something that we know how to treat relatively well, which is fortunate since they're the most common.
It's funny because they're probably. Although they are less heritable, they are more common. But that goes back to the general notion that there's no guarantees when you are parenting at all. Yeah, no matter how your children cope with you.
And even for things like schizophrenia, even if it doesn't run in your family at all, there could be spontaneous mutations that happen. That happened for that particular child. That could give rise. It could be a sort of a de novo mutation that gives rise to schizophrenia in a given child. You know, even though there's no family history of schizophrenia, throughout the entire family line. So,
here's a question from
really
Frances. Helpful. She says, both of my son's birth parents are troubled people. I don't know exactly what their problems are, but both have acted out a lot in the past, and the birth father is in jail for beating up a guy really bad. The mother has gotten her life together more or less now, but she has a really quick temper that has gotten her into trouble in the past. How much of these behaviors are controlled by genes? We have a pretty calm home, and our son is thriving. He has a short attention span and impulse control issues, but then he's only 5 and not really any different from the other 5-year-olds. He is the greatest blessing in our lives, and we just want to be on top of what to look for. I think that she raises a couple of issues, some of which we've already more or less talked about, and that is risk-taking and rule-breaking type behavior. But she also talks about impulse control issues and attention issues, both of which can be associated, and I am not diagnosing Francis's son, but could be associated with things like attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and just general attention. So, Sally Ann, from that standpoint, how heritable are those? And do some of the short attention span and impulse control issues also lead to what we've talked about as risk-taking or antisocial type behaviors?
Those early childhood impulsivity problems are predictive longitudinally of adolescent and adult behaviors. And I don't like the word controlled by genes. I think influenced by genes would be a better way of phrasing that.
Okay.
There is definitely a genetic influence on that. We have a study. We also do twin studies here as well as the adoption study. We have a twin study that's replicating other findings from other people that a child's ability to exercise self-control when they're little is predictive of performance on what's called executive control tasks, goal planning tasks later in their life, which are being able to have good goal planning abilities later makes a big difference in terms of making good decisions. So again, there is definitely a genetic influence on those behaviors that's persistent across the lifespan. But again, I think parental attention to those issues can mediate those kinds of problems. Recognizing that your child is impulsive, but working with them to help them deal with that in various ways would make a difference in later behavior too.
There are excellent. I mean, Frances isn't describing. She isn't describing ADHD by any means, but she's certainly describing a couple of elements of it as you suggested. There are excellent treatments out there for many sorts of childhood psychiatric illnesses, and they don't have to involve medication. You know, there are excellent behavioral treatments for ADHD, for example. So, as I would say this to any parent, adoptive or not, you know your child better than anyone else. You know what their strengths and weaknesses are, and keep an eye on all of the things that you're worried about, and just keep an eye on them and see what you see, and take action if needed.
And I do want to spend some time talking about how environment influences children differently, because I, as a mother of four, I find that very interesting. But before we do, Alex, since you also publish a lot and research a lot on eating disorders, I did want to touch with you. We have a question from Cecilia. She says her son's birth mother is obese. I know she had a dysfunctional childhood that led her to eat to comfort herself. I find that I am very aware of his weight and I worry about it. He isn't fat but is chubby. So just briefly, is obesity influenced by environment and or genetics?
I don't know much about obesity per se. The work that I've been involved in has been with disordered eating, anorexia. Anorexia and bulimia, which are undereating sorts of illnesses.
Yeah.
So I don't know as much, but I would be, I mean, I think as Sally Ann said when the show started, I would be absolutely shocked if there was not a genetic influence on
obesity.
Just
looked up this particular thing, and In this particular study, thousands of pairs of identical twins, a study found that identicals were 0.8 for weight and fraternals 0.43, which indicates a high level of heritability.
High heritability.
And identical twins reared apart correlate 0.72.
So it's really, really heritable. Right?
Really, really heritable.
Yeah, I was going to say, of course, you'd have to have them reared apart for that to be relevant, but that's fascinating. Well,
it's relevant even if they're not reared apart. If you have a difference, as Alex talked about at the beginning of the program, between identical twins and fraternal twins, correlation for
good
identical
point.
Twins is twice that of fraternal twins.
Okay, good point. Yeah, I see your point.
So,
one of the things that I want to allow time to talk about this, Sally Ann, I love the title of one of the recent papers published by Dr. Am I pronouncing his name right?
Plumman.
It's the title of the paper was "Why Are Children in the Same Family So Different from One Another?" Well, you know, that is a question that I have pondered since, as I said, I have four children, both by birth and adoption, and not a one of them is similar to the other.
The first thing I want to tell you is that that paper is not recent. That's a very old paper, actually.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
The original paper.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm hoping that you have an answer to that question, and I really want to hear it.
I think that this is probably one of the most fascinating findings in the field and areas of research, because it's so counterintuitive to what a lot of people expect. You think that family environment affects children the same way. And instead, we find out that pairs of siblings are no more likely to be similar than than they are to unrelated people. And we go, huh? How can that happen?
How can that happen? Because we just talked about the genes.
Right, right. This is an area where we're really trying to work on it. I mean, we don't have good answers for this question. But as an example, let's say both children in the family experience their parents' divorce, but one of them is 13 years old and going through all sorts of agitation that adolescents go through, and the other one is 8 years old and kind of just not really aware of the greater world yet. So even though they're experiencing the same family event, they have different responses to that event. So that's one reason that they can, you know, your response to your similar family environment can be quite different. You also can have different genetic stories that you bring to that situation. One child tends to be happy-go-lucky, so when there's a family problem, it doesn't affect them in the same way that the other sibling who inherited a different set of traits from their parents. Also, children, beginning at a very early age, have different experiences outside the family. In the peer groups they're associated with, one child has a horrible first grade teacher and the other child doesn't. So there's experiences outside the family, there's their different responses to things that happen within the family, and there's a lot of work we need to do in this area because it's a tricky one.
Boy, it is, because honestly, when you look at it, we spent the last hour talking about that a lot of things have a genetic influence. A lot of our personality, a lot of our temperament, a lot of some of what we basically are. So it just seems so intuitive that you would think that biological siblings who have a shared genetic, if they're not identical twins, they would not be the same, but they would have a shared genetic background, and they would have a shared similar environment. So wouldn't the odds just have to be that they would be more similar than two unmatched strangers, and yet apparently not? Alex, do you have
thoughts? No, they are. They are more similar than unmatched strangers, certainly for genetic reasons. I think what Sally Ann was saying was that they're more similar, that to the extent that siblings are similar to each other, it's more for genetic reasons than because of
growing
up.
Right, that is what I was intending to say.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Okay, I misunderstood.
Although there is some evidence that the influence of the family is not surprisingly stronger when the children are young. And it becomes less important as the children age. And I mean, that's certainly consistent with what you think about what you do with your kids as a parent. When they're little, you're really you're controlling and or involved in virtually every aspect of their life. Mm-hmm. The extent that they eat, when they go to the bathroom. I mean, you're there. You're on them. And then when they're adolescents, obviously, you're not doing nearly as much of that anymore, and they're much more interested in their friends. They're less interested in you, when they're adolescents. So there's a developmental thing that happens, of course. But by the time people reach adulthood, to the extent that siblings are similar to each other, it is only because they share genes. So adoptive siblings aren't that similar to each other in adulthood. They are in childhood, oftentimes, but that wanes over time.
Well,
it doesn't mean
it's
not important. It just means that to the extent that exposure to, positive parenting versus negative parenting influences life course development, obviously these things do matter. It's just that over time people kind of become themselves. They become themselves, and hopefully they become the best version of themselves instead of the worst version of themselves. That's what you're aiming for. Basically.
And that is probably a good – we've run out of time, and I am so frustrated because I have so many more questions. But we've run out of time, and that's a very good way to end. And our goal as parents is obviously to try to create environments to the extent we can that will help our children become their best selves. Thank you so much, Sally Ann Ray and Dr. Alexandra Burt, for being our guest today on Creating a Family. Thanks for joining us today, and I will see you next week.
Now at the Home Depot, save up to 35% off appliance special buys. Like the Samsung stainless steel side-by-side refrigerator, just $9.98. You save $300. It's big enough to hold 25 bags of groceries. Unload those, and if that makes you thirsty, you'll really love the external ice maker and water dispenser.
today is the day for doing. Spring Black Friday savings now at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. U.S. only while supplies last. See store for details. Valid through April 17th.
Everything you're hearing is from the Home Depot. From the baseboards and nails to these throw pillows. Even those super soft sheets. Because now at the Home Depot, you can get everything for your bedroom. From wooden nightstands to modern benches. Save up to 25% on select bedroom furniture. Plus free and flexible delivery and easy in-store returns. Shop decor now at HomeDepot.com. More saving, more kinds of doing. Valid on select items online only. Free delivery on select items $45 or more. Visit HomeDepot.com for more information.